right now we have another Nemesis talk by Mr. Carlson. And we'll be talking about methods for combining ICA with jets.
Hello. Hope everybody's still awake. I'm going to broaden my talk a little bit, and I'm going to basically talk about fMRI, ERP, and SNP data, and combining those different data types within an ICA framework. Again, I'll start with the motivation, which I think is pretty straightforward also for this talk, which is that we collect all this different type of data, you know, typically from the same subject. So most studies are doing this. And the type of information contained in these data sets is complementary and different. So, you know, we get electrical activity, hemodynamic activity, structural information, genetic information, neuropsych, behavioral, et cetera. It would make sense to try to use this in particular, in a unified framework. So this is where data fusion comes in, and that's the context I'll be talking about it. So this is my son, and he's doing data fusion of a sort. I'm going to be talking about a different type, and I hope you won't think mine is as messy as that. Maybe you will. Just as a simple example, you know, this is probably the easiest one to motivate, which is that we have electrical activity on a millisecond resolution with EEG. And with fMRI data, we have hemodynamic information, but we're getting it from a very, you know, fairly well-localized position, whereas here we have electrodes on the scalp. So this type of information is complementary, and they can help one another fill in the gaps, so to speak. So I'm going to basically just give a brief introduction to the data types. I'll assume everyone knows what fMRI is already, and just maybe one or two slides on each, starting with ERP. So, you know, with event-related potentials, or with EEG in particular, we've got electrodes on the scalp, and you're basically picking up the electrical activity from bundles of synchronously firing neurons. Each electrode, we get a trace that gives us the electrical activity. And you can take EEG data and compute what's called an event-related potential if you've done an experiment where you are showing stimuli multiple times. And so in the simplest analysis, you could just take that stimuli set and average them together in a time-locked manner to get an event-related potential waveform. And so these waveforms have, you know, peaks that are usually either numbered. You know, P1 is the first positive going, N1 is the first negative going. Also, this could be called, you know, for example, the N200, 200 milliseconds. And this always annoys me, but you have to be careful of the axis. Positive is often down. I think in half of the reports it's down, and half of the reports it's up, because some ERPers are sensitive to history, meaning that you had the trace on a paper, and you were standing on one side of the paper, so it actually was upside down in terms of the sign to you. Whereas I'm of the camp, you know, it's a computer, let's just flip it so it makes sense. But basically, these are warring factions within ERP, so be careful of your axis. And then you heard all about genetics, and I'm going to be focusing on single nucleotide polymorphisms, which is essentially, you know, a mutation at a single base pair that occurs in the population. And as you heard in the previous talk, you know, there may be as many as 30 million SNPs. Currently, it's fairly straightforward to get, you know, a million SNPs. Analysis with existing technology for, you know, maybe $500 or so. So it's about the same cost as an MR scan. I'll be proposing a method for trying to essentially look at the relationship between genetic information, ERP information, and fMRI information, and sort of we'll be looking at these different parts of the triangle here. And so, well, here's the problem. You know, this guy over here has got a box that says 3 billion pieces, and then he's saying, I think I found a corner piece. In imaging data, we're dealing with voxels, and we think we have a lot of voxels, but there's a lot more genetic information. So it's an even bigger issue, how to interpret the results. I think as the previous talk told you very clearly, you have to be careful about how what inferences you make from data, which can fit a lot of different things. So, essentially, we have genetics on one side, we have behavior on the other, and neuroimaging gives us pretty much the best picture we can get in a living human, non-invasively, of some of the interactions going on in brain function. And so it can serve as a link between the genetics and the behavior. So that's enough for introduction on the data, and now I want to talk about just the general concept of joint estimation, which I think probably everyone's already on board with. But if we think about, I've got this written down as a linear sum, so thinking of an ICA framework, but suppose we had a set of sources here, S, from EEG, and then this would be the mixing coefficient A, and then we have our data. And same for fMRI data. And then if we were to, say, do an analysis separately on each of those, so maybe we do temporal ICA on the EEG data and spatial ICA on the fMRI data and estimate the parameters, we would get we would get out some parameters, but we wouldn't know how they relate to one another, because we've done the estimation separately. So it's pretty straightforward. So essentially what we're trying to do, what would make sense to do, is estimate a joint model. So we have basically both fMRI and EEG, and we're estimating a parameter set that jointly fits that data. And then here's just a simple example motivating, the joint information might be useful, because suppose we have fMRI here and ERP here, and we look at the distributions of those separately, you can't see a distinction, between these two groups. But if you were to, say, cut a line like this, between the data, you can actually start to see a separation between those distributions. So everything I'm talking about today is basically biting off only a part of the problem. So I'm going to be working in what I'm calling feature space, meaning I've taken the first level data, and I've processed it using standard approaches. So for example, for fMRI, we compute an activation map. For ERP, we might compute an event-related potential. Okay, so I've used standard approaches to process the data as a starting point, and I'm taking that and moving forward from there and looking at a group model. So you do get an advantage there in that you've taken your data that started out as this size, and you've reduced it down quite a bit. This is helpful. Ideally we'd have kind of a unified, grand unified model that would capture the first level and the second level, but I don't think we're there yet. So this is kind of a spectrum talking about possible approaches for a joint analysis. And so you can think about voxel-based or time-point-based approaches where you look at simply the cross-correlation between two data sets. So ERP and fMRI might be time points by voxels, for example. So that's a straightforward calculation to do, but it's difficult to visualize all those correlations and really to understand how to interpret them. Region-based approaches, where you start with maybe ROIs, specific hypotheses about these five regions might be connected in some way, and then use structural equation modeling or other types of modeling to look at the relationships between those. Also useful, but it does, it obviously will miss brain regions that you don't predict, and it's also assuming that you've got a homogeneous signal within the region of interest. And then a third category is transformation-based, which is what ICA falls into, which is basically to transform your data into a smaller set of modes or components. So, again, this is really, as I was told, maybe not a good picture for blind source separation. This would be better for semi-blind, but that's my son, again, in a bag there. Just reminding you, for ICA, we're looking for directions that maximize independence, and we're looking for structure in the data. I had mentioned stationarity in my earlier talk, and here I'm showing, again, the consistency across various data types, showing it is quite high, However, all four of these data types failed the tests of stationarity. They were highly non-stationary, yet they were highly consistent. And then if we also compare the ICA results with another approach, which is a blind source separation approach that allows for non-stationary sources, you can see that we're getting quite similar results. So that's good. Then I'm going to focus on these two different complementary models today. One is called joint ICA. So in this case, we have a coupled feature matrix where we have our features in this direction, and we're decomposing them into a joint source and a shared contribution matrix. So this direction here is participants, or subjects. And this direction here would be, say, voxels by time points, for example. So this would be an fMRI part and an ERP part. And parallel ICAs is a different approach. In this case, what we're doing is we're doing two ICAs here, and there's a linkage parameter between the two. And so one that we've used is just correlation. So you're assuming a linkage or a correlation possibly between these two modalities. And so this is a joint model where it's basically iteratively updating the two sides. So here's the joint ICA model more graphically. So here we've got our data set, which is activation maps and ERP time courses for so many N subjects, say. We have a joint source that's estimated that has an fMRI part and an ERP part. And then we have a shared mixing matrix. And so here's the generative model. This is the EEG part and the fMRI part. And essentially, if you look at the update equation for ICA, you've got a term that's corresponding to the fMRI data and another term corresponding to the EEG data. And you're estimating this W, which is your unmixing matrix. Okay, so let's look at an example on some real data. So here's the chain of processing. So if we take our fMRI data, we compute an activation map for each subject. And likewise, we take the EEG data and compute an event-related potential. This, again, is auditory oddball data. So this is time-locked to the target response. So remember, for the targets, we had an infrequent high tone that required a button press. It generates an oddball response, and it also should generate motor activity. And this data was just processed using a standard GLM. Again, time-locked to the target response. And then in this case, we removed the joint components that had an ERP, basically a flat ERP time course. So if it was less than one standard deviation from zero, it was removed, essentially calling it noise. So if we do this, we get out a set of joint features. So here I'm showing six joint components, and each one has an fMRI part and an ERP part. So this yellow curve is the same in all. That's just the average across subjects. So this data set was 22 individuals who had ERP and fMRI, and those were collected in separate sessions, by the way. And then this blue curve corresponds to the ERP part of that joint component. So we get information about where and about when this signal is occurring, and what we've assumed is that there's the same covariation. So, you know, for example, if you were to take the peak, this time point, and take the value at that time point for all subjects, and do the same for, say, this large valued voxel, and correlate them, they'd probably be correlated fairly strongly. And so then, once we have this, we can visualize it in various ways. So these are ordered in terms of time. So you can see this is the N100 response, and it has bilateral temporal lobe. N200, we get motor planning and some primary motor starting to come in. This is more of a triphasic response here, and here are the P3 responses, and here's a later response. So we can take this and visualize it by creating a movie for any given point in time. We have values for each of the ERP parts of the joint component that are linked to the fMRI, and so we then can use that to create a linear combination of the fMRI at that point in time. So if you just watch this, assuming it plays, you know, we get initial motor planning, motor execution, and here we get the, right there we get the P3 response, and then the late response. And if you look at this in detail, it actually makes a lot of sense in terms of what you would have predicted is going on in this oddball. And we've kind of sidestepped around the inverse problem here. So we're not actually doing, you know, inverse modeling and trying to estimate a source or location directly from only the EEG data. So we're looking at it in a different way here. And we can do the transpose of that. And we can take for any given point in the brain, we have values for the fMRI components, and we know they're linked ERP components. So we can reconstruct an ERP corresponding to that voxel. So, you know, here is the motor planning, and you see the peak is occurring, you know, at the first around 100 milliseconds or so. Motor execution here, primary motor, the peak is occurring later, around 200 milliseconds. So. And we can take this a step further and look at, you know, more than one electrode. So that previous example was just with a single central electrode, which pretty much picks up everything. But you're losing a little bit of the ERP information because you haven't used all the electrodes. So if we use all the electrodes, we can get you know, the ERP response for a given component, the topography from the EEG, and then the fMRI information. So it gives you kind of a joint way to look at all this data. I think it provides a lot more information than if you were to do these analyses separately from one another. Okay, so now let's look at parallel ICA. What we're doing here, if we think about fMRI and SNP data, we're interested in, you know, not looking at the correlation of a single SNP to you know, each voxel in the fMRI study. We want to try to look at a multivariate association of SNPs with, likewise, a multivariate pattern of fMRI voxels. So the covariation here is at the subject level. So we're looking for something that has a common covariation or a correlation between the SNP data and the fMRI data. And each of these is associated with a SNP component, which gives us, you know, values telling us the contribution that the SNPs are making, and likewise an fMRI image corresponding to which voxels are contributing the most. So then this is the structure I showed you earlier for parallel ICA. So we have an ICA here and an ICA here, and then a linkage between the two. And so what we're doing is basically maximizing, this is assuming the InfoMax algorithm, so that actually turns out to be the same as maximizing the entropy of Y1, which is X1 passed through a nonlinear function. So I know I didn't go into that algorithm, but trust me on that. And subject to maximizing this correlation between the two mixing matrices, which is looking at correlations between fMRI and SNP data covariant between subjects. Now, a couple other tricks is that we have dynamically constrained components. So we allow for one or more of the components to actually have a constraint of correlation. And we have an adaptive approach for that. Likewise, the strength of that correlation term is also adaptively determined. So, you know, this is just a picture here to remind me of, we're still doing lots of simulations for this. You know, this simple, you know, case here was just to generate some toy sources and see if the algorithm is working and look at the impact of, you know, the number of sources or the actual true correlation value on the results. But what we're doing now is actually doing more realistic simulations where we're using, you know, genetic models to simulate the SNP data. And likewise, we're trying to generate realistic fMRI data and then looking at how this algorithm is performing on that data. Because obviously this isn't very realistic, particularly. This was just generating some random, you know, functions from MATLAB. But it does give us an idea of how the algorithm is working. So essentially, we're using classic ICA algorithms in here and trying to extract independent sources while also identifying the connections between the two data types. So let's look at a study, just some results here from an fMRI study where we looked at, here we had 20 schizophrenia patients and 43 healthy controls. One of the things that we found is, so this isn't a particularly large study. We had a lot, we had a number of extra subjects, but we had to remove them because they were, for example, different ethnicities. We didn't have enough of a sample size to estimate. We had six that were a non-Caucasian, for example. And if we included those, they completely skewed the results. So we had to kind of filter out to get a more homogeneous data set here. And we, again, used an auditory oddball task, target-related activity. This was these days a relatively small SNP array. It's about 384 SNPs. We actually ended up with 367. So we used parallel ICA, and we identified one linked SNP fMRI component. And what we, so this is sort of a preliminary result, but it was encouraging because we were, we basically had these bilateral frontal areas. There's some temporal pole in here, and then there's some, more posterior regions, which made sense to us. And the other thing was this array was designed more for a metabolic study. So it didn't have all of the, the brain-related SNPs that we would have included. But the ones that were in there were at the top of the list. And in addition, you can see that, these pink ones here are the ones that have been previously implicated in schizophrenia. So it was encouraging to us that those were kind of up at the top because the profile showed a difference between controls and patients. So then we basically have a set of areas and a set of SNPs that we think might be linked, and we can use this information in follow-up studies, essentially, to test it. Here's the SNP profile and the fMRI, the SNP component, say, and the fMRI component. And you can see that the patients are clearly showing a difference between the controls. Okay. So there's a lot of different things that we're doing now. So we have, we have SNP data now that gives us, I think it's 1,030,000 SNPs or so. So then the question is, okay, how does this impact our need for larger sample sizes? And I think this was talked about a lot in the previous talk. Do we need larger sample sizes if we have more SNPs that we're testing? And so here I'm showing some data from UCI, which we had 100,000 SNPs in this data set, and this was a working memory paradigm. And we found a fairly stable result. What I'm showing you here is essentially, as you go in this direction, we're increasing the SNP to subject ratio. And we found here a very consistent result, which gave us a fairly nice looking activation in our component. But then once we got beyond a certain level, it started to break down a little bit. I think this is going to be an important factor in the results, and we need larger sample sizes in order to see if we need larger sample sizes. That's one of the problems. But I think it's important to evaluate this. Okay, and let me just show you one more example looking at ERP data. So this is in healthy controls only. This is 41 healthy subjects in an oddball task. So we have, 384 SNPs. And we wanted to look at whether there was, basically wanted to try to see what, ask the question, what is the genetic underpinning of the oddball response, the target-related oddball response and the novel-related oddball response. So here is the target result and here is the novel result. We essentially did two parallel ICAs. So that's parallel ICA, I guess. So the N200 component here, this yellow curve, was found to be linked to these corresponding SNPs here. And here's the correlation between the SNP and the ERP. And the striking thing for us was if you look at this list of SNPs, we've got a lot of adrenergic SNPs in here, but you know the first five or so are the same for both the target stimuli and the novel stimuli, suggesting you know some common genetic underpinning for these two. Essentially, they're both oddball responses, but one is a salient oddball response, and one is an oddball response to a non-salient stimulus. You can go a step further then, and once you, you know, this, I think that I'm gaining a newfound respect for geneticists because I think it's a lot. It's fairly, it's very complicated, I guess to put it that way. So, for example, we can take these SNPs. You know, so we can't just say, well, these. You can say the SNPs are correlated, but you've got, you know, some different functions associated with each SNP, and you have a lot more SNPs than you have brain regions. And you know, we can take these SNPs, and then we can say, well, what are the biological pathways that they're related to? So there's software out there to do that. This is produced by the Ingenuity Pathway software. So we basically take our SNPs, and it looks for you know direct and indirect links between common biological pathways. So you can see we've got dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine, etc. I think there's a lot of work to be done to really fully understand. Once you get these joint models, you have to be able to interpret them. You know, this gives us a lot of information. And I think I've about finished my talk. We have a toolbox that implements, again, the joint ICA approach and the parallel ICA approach. It's at the same place the GIFT software is. With that, I will say thank you very much.
Questions for Vince?
Just a clarification. In the joint ICA, it wasn't clear to me exactly what you were feeding in for the fMRI result. Is it the actual SPF?
Yeah, it's the essentially the parameter estimates. The regression parameter estimates?
The betas,
yeah. You can also feed in, I should be feeding in the ICA components, actually, but...
Question back there?
So, the work with correlating the SNPs and the fMRI data, you had 20-something people, some 40-something patients, or vice versa. The result of the image that you showed there,
We're getting out a single, in this case, a single image from both. I guess we could actually construct the subject-specific image and a control-specific image. We didn't. That's more like the average. Where you get the subject information is in the SNP profile that I showed, those green and pink curves that had subject on this axis and it had fMRI and SNP. So that tells you, you know, something about how they're co-varying individually.
So you have another question?
So you're doing the fMRI acquired simultaneously or
in this case it was done separately. Yeah, so we're relying upon common, you know, responses to the oddball task. And the behavior we did test and it was insignificantly different, so non-different.
Have you gone and applied the joint and the parallel to the same data?
We've looked at that a little bit, yeah. They kind of
evolved in parallel, so to speak, and two different sets of folks are working on it. So we're actively looking at comparing. I mean, there's actually other models that we have as well. They make different assumptions. In particular, if you've got a case where the covariation is different, between, say, the patients and controls, then you're probably not going to capture that one very well in the joint ICA model, but you would capture that, you capture that better in the parallel because it's allowing them to be separate parameters. It's a looser relationship.
So I may be missing something here, but I guess I would have tried to do the joint by using canonical correlations. So have you tried that?
Yeah, we've done it. We've done CCA.
And I'm curious, how does that compare?
The question was joint with
canonical correlations analysis. So you're looking for the linear combination across the subject betas that matches the linear combination across the AFPs.
Right. I mean, the key difference is the sparsity assumption, I think, between PCA and ICA. So the sparseness is actually helpful. For example, for the ERP, we get these very distinct, responses to the different, components that people know are present in ERP. Whereas for CCA, it's not that sparse. However, we did, capture in CCA exactly the relationship I mentioned to Tom, where we had a correlation difference between the patients and controls that wasn't properly captured in the joint ICA. So we have a paper where we've compared the two. So we've done it for that comparison, but not for joint ICA and parallel ICA.
Can you compare the joint ICAs using the fMRI activations to reconstruct the inverse solution to EEG data?
No. And you could also use the output of joint ICA and feed that into an inverse model to reconstruct where is it coming from. So I think that would be interesting to do as well. But the issue with the inverse model is you have to make some assumptions about either number of sources or locations, etc.
Right, so restrict that from the fMRI results.
Right, but the issue is in that case. So I guess I forgot my motivational slide, which is that. So the joint ICA is, I think, more symmetric in terms of how it treats the data. So we're looking for sort of a joint output from both. This type of a constrained approach is useful and gives you good results, but you've made a strong assumption that your fMRI data, is useful to constrain your EEG data, but that's it. And you have the issue of hidden sources and extra, false sources to deal with. I mean, although there are lots of people working on this, and it's a very interesting approach, but I tend to pursue more the symmetric.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank Vince again.